supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Age 23, a very young man. That's the age of Michael Phelps, and he's on top of the world. After striking gold over 10 times, he may be the greatest swimmer, the greatest athlete of all time. But how do athletes like Phelps deal with the overwhelming pressures to be the best, the relentless pressure? And what does he do when his career's over? After spending so much time focused on his sport, how does a professional athlete function normally in the rest of their lives? Today, the mental pressure athletes face before, during, and after the game. My guests are Dr. David Barron. He's chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Temple University School of Medicine. He's worked with Olympic athletes for over 25 years. He joins me here in the studio. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm also joined by Dr. Joel Fish on the telephone. He's a sports psychologist, director of the Center of Sports Psychology in Philadelphia. He's written 101 Ways to Be a Terrific Sport Parent. Joel, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. Great to be with you.
And I'm also joined on the telephone by Carlos Bradley. He's a former linebacker with the San Diego Chargers. He played from 81 to 86. He was with the Eagles in 87. He's currently executive vice president of the International Student Athlete Academy, where he trains young athletes in academics and life skills, as well as sports. Carlos, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
David, let me start with you. On Saturday, Michael Phelps obtained his 8th gold medal. He's broken all records and is considered the greatest swimmer, if not greatest athlete of all time. Where does he go from here?
Well, I think that's an excellent question. He probably can go anywhere he wants to go, given his notoriety. I've dealt with athletes, I know Dr. Fish has as well, over the years, and it seems as if there are some athletes make this transition very smoothly. They have a plan, they have good managers, they have good family and supports, and they're able to make the transition. Unfortunately, some don't make it quite so well. So I think a lot that will buy into this, how he goes to this next segment of his life, will be the support systems. He's moving back home to be with his mother and his family down there, his coach. My suspicion is he'll stick around and will certainly swim in the 2012 games in London.
Joel, at the Olympic level, all athletes have pretty much the same level of skills. I mean, it's, you know, the differences are probably very small. So what's the difference between a gold medalist and one who doesn't qualify?
Well, in my work from a sports psychology perspective with athletes, the question I always ask them first is, what percentage of performance is mental? Confidence, composure, concentration, communication, teamwork, and they're all saying it's largely mental. To me, what separates the Michael Phelps and the other gold medal winners is how they deal with pressure. At that moment, you can handle pressure in one of two ways. You can either attack it, go for it, see it as an opportunity, as a challenge, as a positive motivator, or you can get tentative with it because you don't want to make a mistake. What Phelps has done better than anybody else, I think, is attack the pressure, the expectations, go for it, come on, let's see if you can beat me. And I think, as Dr. Barron applied too, he's also got a balanced approach. If he goes out there with that attitude and he gives it his best effort, he's defined success in such a way that he's going to come out of that pool feeling okay about himself no matter what happens.
David, you talk about emotional toughness. That sounds kind of like what Joel was talking about.
Yes, it really is. You know, it's not only a psychological issue. Actually, we know there are biological correlates. Some folks are just better to handle stress And this is some really elegant research that's been going on demonstrating that it really is a biopsychosocial phenomena. And I think what we see, as Dr. Fish mentioned, is you certainly have to have the biological underpinnings. And we've seen all the stories on the television on how his body, is developed in such a way. But clearly that alone won't do it. It's the psychosocial areas and his ability, as Dr. Fish mentioned, to kind of channel his stresses into a positive, a eustress, as it were, to drive him on to victory.
I forgot to give out the numbers at the top of the show. It's 1-888-477-9499. Again, 888-477-9499. We're talking about the mind of athletes, what it's like to get there, to be there, and to stay there. Give us a call. Joel, so we know athletic excellence is a combination of talent and personality or attitude, as we've been talking about. But we also have to understand, I mean, these athletes start when they're young kids. So we've got to understand the mindset of parents who put their children to work for a goal as young as 5 years old. I mean, sometimes that's good judgment. Sometimes that's parental narcissism.
Absolutely. And there's so many lessons to draw, I think, as parents from the Olympics. And one lesson is certainly persevere. Take a look at the gymnast. Take a look at Michael Phelps. And, you know, persevere in those tough times and good things can happen. And they can. On the other hand, I've seen a lot of families have to make decisions about whether to move their child, whether to specialize their child, whether really to devote a lot of resources and time to an older child and bring the younger child along. Sometimes it just doesn't make sense. And one of the things that I think is an opportunity for parents to talk about as we watch the Olympics is, does it add up and does it make sense? And the other thing that I've learned in working with adolescents is that's a question that families have to revisit every year or two times a year. Just because you want to put your daughter or son on the fast track of gymnastics when they're 10, maybe they're in a different place when they're 11 because of so many changes that go on physically and emotionally and interest-wise and identity-wise. So to me, these are family questions that really have to be looked at in terms of, does it make sense for the child, does it make sense for the family, for who that child is today, not who they were 1 year ago or who they might be a year from today.
And that decision, I imagine, has to be done almost independent of talent. You've got to look at that child because, and I want to come to your phrase, David, emotional toughness, this issue of tenacity and fighting through the stress and anxiety. It might be fine for athletes at the top of their game, but for a younger person, that could be abuse. If a child is suffering and losing motivation and they're being pushed through it anyway, I mean, that's going to harm the child.
Well, it absolutely can. And I think one of the things we've seen, as you know, the Olympic gymnasts tend to be quite young, particularly the women. And when I was involved with the 96 games, there was lots of discussion that we really needed to change and raise the age limit because there was, as you say, there was talk of, was this verging on child abuse, what was going on? And we have, the Olympic, the IOC has raised it to 16. There have been some questions about the Chinese athletes. But I think you raise a very important point, and Dr. Fish really talked on hit on it as well, and that's things change for the athlete. And I think it's those athletes who are able to maintain that focus, that, in that cost-benefit rate, they get something out of it. And I truly believe that these folks are wired a bit differently. I think that biologically, that the ones that reach that ultra-elite level, that there are some uniqueness about them because, as you said, it's more than just physical talent.
Name it. Can you? You said wired differently, and that makes all the sense in the world. Can you name that uniqueness? I'll start with you, David, and I want to ask Joel to try to tackle it too.
Well, I really, we've made some wonderful advances in understanding kind of how the brain works. For example, we know that certain people are at greater risk to develop PTSD when exposed to a stress. It's not just a psychological phenomena, but it's, again, as I mentioned earlier, it's a biopsychosocial thing. I really believe that as we continue to move forward, in fact, I've done some work with a colleague of mine with the Canadian Olympic swim team, and some preliminary work really looking at the brains are wired a bit differently in these folks. And again, that in and of itself doesn't make them an Olympic athlete, but I think it's part of the formula.
Joel? You agree, and can you name names? Can you describe that differentness?
Well, I agree that to make it to the Olympics, it's a one in a million talent, and it's a one in a million personality. You take a look at Tiger Woods, and he could handle pressure the first time he picked up a golf club at the age of three. And so I think the trait that separates the gold medal people from everybody else, again, is their ability just to handle the stress and the pressure and expectations. And what I've learned is there's no relationship between having an Olympic personality and an Olympic talent. And there are a lot of people who are, in essence, weeded out of the system because they can't handle or aren't able to handle the stress and pressure that every level you go up requires. And the biggest issue that the parents bring to me is, you know, should my child who's talented play up in age? And I'm always saying you have to assess that question not only if they have the physical talent, but do they have the emotional talent and the psychological talent to handle the expectations? Because to me, that becomes the key factor as to whether a kid can thrive as they go up the system or not.
We're talking about the mind of an athlete today on Voices. Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking with David Barron, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Temple, Joel Fish, a sports psychologist, and Carlos Bradley, a former linebacker who played with the San Diego Chargers. Carlos, I'd like to talk with you about your background. When did you first realize you had talent?
Well, when I first started playing football, I was about 12, 13. And I don't know if I realized I had talent, but I had a drive to want to excel. And I was able to then focus my energies and my talent in that direction. At the time, I was thinking about playing soccer, playing football, running track, and I ended up limiting myself to running track and playing football in high school.
And that drive was inside of you, yes?
Yeah, you know, I had conversations with my mother. She's since passed, but, you know, she always said, you know, we never pushed you, I never pushed you. You set your mind to something, and then you just worked in that direction. So I think once I saw my abilities and just started channeling it, and then I just didn't want to fail. My biggest thing, because my mother would always say, be the best you could be at whatever you choose to do, be a trash man or anything else. So I was just trying to be the best I could be and get the most out of my talent.
So your mother didn't push you, but
no, it was,
did she nurture your athletic achievement?
You know what? She didn't nurture me, my athletics at all, but she did nurture my mind in directing me to do and to do the best I could do. So that was her driving statement.
Was there
be the best that you could be?
So at what point did you realize, or did anyone else realize,
well,
that there was the potential for real excellence here?
Right at 14, when I was young, coming out of high school, I was 16 as a senior. And when I was 14, I can remember the first time I ran my 40, the coach called the other coach over and said, I think we got something here. And from that point on, it just kept growing. I then became captain, and then, you know, everything else fell in line. I then made All-City and All-State and All-American, and then it just kept escalating. So the coach noticed that I had a different drive than everybody else. He also noticed my coachability. When he would say, I want you to do this, then I was able to execute it very well. So by my senior year, he didn't really have to say anything. He would take my ankles, have a conversation, and oddly enough, he would let me call the whole defensive signals and everything else as a 16-year-old senior.
So you were like we've been talking about, you were a young man who was driven, who had talent. You had that combination.
Right. That was the combination. And then it was coaches that then the coaches then nurtured it and allowed me to just express what I was doing, just allowed it to come out.
Huh. Well, we're going to come back to you. I think we just developed a bad connection with your phone, so we'll come back to you in a minute. David, part of what you deal with is the negative impact of all this stress that that we've been talking about. You deal with athletes who might have anxiety disorders or depression. Is the incidence higher, you think, for athletes, and do the symptoms look different?
I believe the symptoms do look a bit different. Certainly the core symptoms are the same. In fact, one of my areas of research interest now is developing a specific screener for depression in athletes. I think just like we see children and adolescents when they get depressed sometimes don't look the same as adults when they get depressed.
Right, right.
I think we see the same thing. I really view athletes, and Joel's really made a career of viewing athletes. You know, there's some similarities, but there are clearly some differences. When we look at what are the real incidences of depression, I don't think we really have good data. These aren't the easiest groups to follow to do depression screeners, and I think many of the ones that we use in clinical research maybe really aren't as valid or reliable in this unique population.
Well, there's another factor, too. I mean, we know that shame is a terrible problem with mental illness and prevents people from getting treatment, and we know from Sean Andrews, the Eagles linebacker, who just missed most of practice because he had depression. We know that he didn't talk about it for a long time, probably because of his shame. And then he comes out and opens up, and we get some of these, you know, radio talk show hosts who don't have a great deal of knowledge, which doesn't prevent them from proselytizing about things, and that adds to the shame. So I wonder if shame is worse for professionalized.
Well, I think shame and stigma. I mean, unfortunately, the stigma of mental illness is global. I've done work in other countries where it's actually even more significant than it is here. Certainly in Asia, there's a huge stigma, and it's one of the issues that the World Psychiatric Association is dealing with in a big way. And I think with athletes, you know, they're always looking for that competitive edge. We've been talking about it from the mental perspective. And I know Dr. Fish has really, you know, had his whole career dealing with that mental edge. What I've seen over the years in dealing with athletes is what it means when you start getting down, when you start doubting yourself, which can be some of the core symptoms of depression or an anxiety disorder, that when these athletes, when that starts to come in, it almost always will have a fairly immediate impact on their ability to perform at the highest level.
I really want to underscore what you said, not just for athletes, but for everyone, that when you start to doubt yourself, that's a symptom. That doesn't mean you have depression or an anxiety disorder, but that's a symptom, and it really needs to be seen that way. It's not a weakness or anything else, but self-doubt is a key symptom of depression or an anxiety disorder.
I think related to that is athletes learn that you just work harder. If you want to get faster, you just work harder. And when you have a mood disorder, you can't just work harder. This is something that's really alien to them, the fact that, you know, it's something new and different. I think this is some of the problems I've seen with athletes when they transition from their competitive days to non-competition, where you don't have those same goals and you can't just work harder. And I think shows like this are very important because, as you say, this is not restricted just to athletes, but it clearly has an important part of athletic performance.
And we're going to talk after our break. We're going to talk about what happens to athletes after they retire, or worse, or forced to retire by dint of injury. We're talking today on Voices in the Family about the mind of athletes, what it takes to get there, what it takes to stay there, and what happens when they leave. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. My guests are Dr. David Barron. He's chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Temple, and he's worked with Olympic athletes for 25 years. Joel Fish is director of the Center for Sports Psychology in Philadelphia, and he's written 101 Ways to Be a Terrific Sports Parent. I'm also joined by Carlos Bradley. He's a former linebacker with the San Diego Chargers. He's executive vice president of the International Student Athlete Academy, and we're going to hear more about that after our break. Again, the number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, in anticipation of the Democratic and Republican conventions, we listen back to some of the earliest and most influential presidential campaign ads with David Schwartz of the American Museum of the Moving Image. And we hear the story of the Democratic Convention of 1968 and the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're taking a look inside the mind of athletes, athletes at the higher level of performance, professional athletes, Olympic athletes. My guests are Dr. Joel Fish. He's director of the Center of Sports Psychology in Philadelphia. David Barron is chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Temple. He's been working with Olympic athletes for over 25 years. And Carlos Bradley, a former linebacker with the San Diego Chargers and the Eagles. He's executive vice president of the International Student Athlete Academy. And our number is 888-477-9499. Before our break, we were talking about depression and some of the symptoms of depression and issues of stigma and shame, especially with athletes. Carlos, can I ask you, have you ever had to deal with anxiety and depression?
Never, not myself. No, I've never had that. But a number of student athletes and professional athletes also that I've worked with, they've dealt with some of these issues. And, you know, they could be brought on by what's currently going on in their life. But what I've found is that it usually stems from something deeper in their lives, something that's happened way before their sports. It even could have been with what I call the original relationship, which is with your parents.
Yeah, usually stress activates something that that's right. Already there, and the something that's already there is often a genetic predisposition. But let me ask you how your fellow athletes, friends of yours, certainly colleagues of yours, how they dealt with their depression. Did they not talk about it, pretend it wasn't there? Tell me how that looked in the locker room.
As the doctors said, athletes are used to just trying to work through things. With depression, as you know, it's not, you can't just work harder and get over it. So what they've had to do is actually remove themselves from that stress, take that stress out of their lives, and then deal with the other things in their life, and then try to bring it back in and keep it a positive in their life. The athletics usually is an outlet. What I find with the student athletes that I work with now, that through their athletics, they're allowed to express themselves. Oftentimes at home or in a bad family situation, they aren't able to express themselves or they aren't able to be emotional at all. And that's when depression sometimes sets in, and sometimes anxiety if it's a certain situation with a parent that's violent or something like that. But they normally have to remove the stress of the sport and get outside of that, and then get everything straight in their life, and then hopefully bring the sport back in.
Yeah, so you know,
being a positive.
Something like depression, for those of us who have experienced it, really help you get your life in perspective. And there is nothing more important than caring for your mind, no matter what you do with your life. Care for your own mind, your own brain, however you want to look at it. There's nothing more important than that. David, you know, the standard treatment for depression is, you know, psychotherapy and medication. Tell us about medication with athletes, the standard antidepressants, anti-anxiety medication. Does it affect performance? Does it show up in the urine as a banned substance?
Well, this is really a key point when you're dealing with Olympic athletes or now professional athletes that have doping programs. I've been heavily involved with Olympic doping since 84, and this comes up time and again. Is this going to come up positive if I take an antidepressant? Is it going to be the end of my career? And in regards to psychotherapy, I found cognitive behavioral therapy being one that athletes do very well with. For the listeners who aren't really familiar with that, it's kind of identifying automatic negative thoughts and kind of challenging those. And I think this is a technique, actually a technique developed here by Aaron Beck in Philadelphia, so one of our own native sons, that works particularly well with athletes.
It fits the athletic mentality. Absolutely. It says, you know, here's a task that you have to master it, and here's how. In this case, it's your mind.
As far as the drugs, one can get an exception when you're on any drug. You've got to go through the paperwork. In fact, I thought it was interesting that it came out that Michael Phelps dealt with ADHD as a kid and was treated with medications and then was able to stop and used his swimming as really a way of, it sounded like almost of therapy, and as Carlos mentioned just a few moments ago. So in regards to the drugs, athletes are very worried that it's going to have a negative effect on their performance.
And
I think for some, what I try to tell them is, you know, this drug isn't going to make you better or worse. It will hopefully make you the best you, that you're right now you've got some things that we need to deal with.
Will it show up in the urine?
Well, you can certainly, all the drugs can be tested for in the urine. Again, one can get a medical exemption saying that they're being treated for a disorder. So even if it is a banned substance, it can be dealt with. And there are quite a number of Olympic athletes, I can tell you, who are on psychotropic medications of all types. And they get the medical clearance, and these don't come up as a positive test.
Interesting. Let's go to the phones. We've got Rob on the line. Rob, hi. You're on the air.
Yes, Bob. Thanks. Bob from New Jersey.
Okay. Hi.
Hi. You guys are focusing on elite athletes, but my questions are relative to student athletes. I think there's a relationship there. You talked about emotional and mental toughness. And my question is, there's a trend out there, and there are courses and training for mental toughness, particularly with student athletes. Do you feel that mental or emotional toughness can be taught, can be trained? And then secondly, relative to parents and student athletes, there's a fine line between encouraging your student athlete and pushing your student athlete too far. So are there some guidelines for parents to ensure that they're encouraging and not pushing the student too far?
Well, I'll tell you this before I turn your question to Joel Fish. One way to find guidelines on that precise issue is to read a wonderful book called 101 Ways to Be a Terrific Sports Parent by Joel Fish. Joel, do I get some rebate on that plug?
Thank you, Dan.
So what tackle Bob's question.
Well, in terms of can mental toughness be taught versus or is it something you're born with, I could never be Tiger Woods, and I don't think we're all starting at the same starting point, let's say on a scale of 1 to 10 with mental toughness. But wherever our starting point is, I do think we can improve, and I think we can teach our kids positive self-talk and relaxation techniques and visualization so that when they're in that pressure situation, they feel like they've been there before. They have some tools to help them handle that pressure better. So I really do believe that we can teach kids some skills to help them handle pressure better. In terms of pushing the kids versus not, I do think it really comes down to your child. I know my older son, who's in college now, when he tried something new, it could be sport or art or music, when he hit a bump in the road, when it got hard, his initial reaction was one to stop. And what we learned is if he could just get through that first or second practice, hang in there, good things will happen. More often than not, it did. So, you know, the art of parenting in terms of nudging your kid versus choosing not to have him or her continue obviously is really related to the personality of the child. And my final thought is I do think as parents, depression with athletes can come in a different shape and form, and that athletes of all ages, youth sport to the pros, have certain vulnerable points. And in my work with athletes, when a child has been cut or a pro has been cut, when a child's been injured or a pro has been injured, when it's time to transition out of the sport, these become vulnerable times for what we'd call a reactive depression, a depression to an incident you could put your finger on. And I think as parents or as coaches, if we have our antennae up for those key moments, I think we can intervene in a way to provide support to decrease the chances that that response of depression is going to get out of control.
I want to add one other thing to what you're saying, Joel. And Bob, I hope that answered your question. There's a book written by Jon Kabat-Zinn and his wife Maya, and the title of the book was called Parenting from the Inside Out. And when you are making these assessments that both Joel and David are talking about on the air, about, you know, looking at your kid and doing what's in the best interest of your kid and not just the outcome, I think the first place to look is inside. What's happening inside? What are your goals? What's your anxiety about? What is it that you need that maybe you're encouraging your child to get for you? And I think that's got to be the first question. That's parenting 101 right there, whether you have an athlete or not. Just be truthful with yourself about what's going on inside your heart.
I would agree so much with you, Dan, that the first part of the book you referred to is all about parents trying to understand what their own attitudes are about winning and losing and success and failure and competition. And I've had a chance to speak to parents groups all over the country, and every parent is going to agree with what we're saying here today. But something emotional, it's not logical, emotional gets activated when you see your kid up there with the bases loaded, or you see the coach talking to your daughter in a certain way, or you see your son not playing, you think he should. It's not a logical response, it's an emotional response, and that self-awareness on the parent's part is no question step one towards being able to help your child through that.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. It's close to impossible, but it's pretty pretty simple. Carlos, I want to bring you in here on precisely this issue. At the International Student Athlete Academy, you work with young kids on not just athletics, but academics. So how do you know when to push, when to let go, when to focus more on academics?
Well, our program is designed that student athlete that comes to us, they play for their school, they have a decent school average, and they want to get better, is the athletes we look for. A lot of them go on to college, but a lot of them don't go on to pros. What I find, and I wanted to echo in as you were talking, problems come in when the parents' egos get involved, as your other guests were saying. When the parents' egos, because their own emotions get involved in pushing the kid, I think you really have to take a step back and let the kid decide which direction he wants to go. I think we can all get better in our mental focus, in our the way we approach the game, but physically, we just try to push or get the most out of the kid that's already there. We don't ask them to do anything they can't do, and if they can't do it, so be it. You know, they can't do it. There is no failure in trying. So we just ask them to try their best, and that's what we accept.
Hmm. We're talking about the I guess the overall psychology of athletics. What's in the mind of athletes at every level? Our number is 888-477-9499. We're talking with David Barron, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Temple. He's been working with athletes for 25 years. Joel Fish runs the Center for Sports Psychology in Philadelphia. And Carlos Bradley is a former linebacker who played with the San Diego Chargers and the Eagles later in his career. He's executive vice president of the International Student Athletic Academy, where he trains young athletes in academics, life skills, as well as sports. When we come back, we want to talk about what happens with athletes at the end of their career. Our number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
More and more people are turning to the internet to learn about their world and themselves.
On the blogs that I read, a lot of us are talking about a lot of the cultural issues, a lot of the issues that define us as African Americans.
I'm Farai Chidea. Tap into the topics that have Black America talking. Join us for the Bloggers Roundtable next time on News and Notes.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
next time on Day to Day.
Watch Cheech and Chong travel to Mexico to pick up the world's first van made entirely of marijuana.
If Cheech and Chong want weed these days, there's no need to cross the border.
Weed is from the herb. Take advantage, man.
And lots of Californians are taking advantage. But is it legal?
The federal law prevails.
The California dream of medical marijuana.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the psychology of these athletes, from young kids to Olympians. My guests are Carlos Bradley. He's a former linebacker with the Chargers and the Eagles. He's executive vice president of the International Student Athlete Academy. Joel Fish is a sports psychologist, director of the Center for Sports Psychology in Philadelphia. He's written 101 Ways to Be a Terrific Sport Parent. And David Barron, chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Temple. And he's worked with Olympic athletes for 25 years. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Bob on the line. Bob? Bob, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I also got a doctorate in sports psychology and sociology from Temple back in the 80s. In fact, my study was self-concept and former athletes. Identity and what we have created in this strange American dream for athletes, I think, has caused a lot of problems in terms of when you let it go, and you're going to let it go sooner or later. My question is, particularly for, you know, Joel Fish and the other guests, how are they dealing with, or are they, I know they're aware of, but how are they dealing with the athlete's identity at a high level, and then it's suddenly just falling off? I had a study of Fred Shiro at Temple, and he said he personally knew five pro hockey players who committed suicide in the first year after their careers ended.
Well,
answer off the phone.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call. Well, you know, you mentioned David Barron and Joel Fish, but I want to go to Carlos first to address this issue. Carlos, when did you realize your career was ending, near its end?
I went from the Chargers. Actually, I went from the Chargers to Cleveland, and then ended up with the Eagles. But what I realized, Dan, the whole time I was playing, which I think a lot of athletes don't do, is I looked at this as one phase of my life. I think a lot of athletes start getting accolades when they're very young, 12, 13, and they are the man, they are the best around. Everyone looks up to them throughout their whole career. And then when your career is over, you have this major euphoric loss, just a drop-off in your life, because no one's at your beck and call. People aren't asking for your autograph anymore. And it just falls off. So the whole time I was trying in my mind to prepare myself for the next phase of life and just looking at pro football and athletics as part of it. Once it ended, then it was time to shift those same energies, which is what I try to teach the student athletes in ISAA, shift those same energies into academics or into another career, another profession.
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying that you made this transition? You must have had some anxiety or depression or a sense of loss. If not, man, I want a pint of your blood.
No. Your whole life, Dan. Willie Davis years ago played for the Packers, and he became a multimillionaire in the business world. And they asked him what feels better, you know, sacking a quarterback or making $1 million in the boardroom. He said nothing will ever replace the feeling of being on a field and 60,000 people cheering for you. So to say I didn't miss it, to say there wasn't some drop off, to say every day I don't think about, you know, that roar of the crowd, yes. But I take that same feeling now when it fell off into some degree of depression, very slightly. I don't really feel I ever felt depressed. I felt like, okay, what am I going to do next? And then it was just time to move into something else and try to become good at something else. That's the way I looked at it personally.
I would suggest, and I'll turn to you, David, that Carlos is in a minority because by virtue...
I'd agree with that.
Yeah, but by virtue of the training, I mean, these, say, the Olympic athletes, they begin at young age focusing only on themselves, only on athletics. So what's to prevent them from having a steep drop-off at the end, David?
Well, I can share with you a case without mentioning a name just within the last month of an Olympic athlete who is competing over in Beijing now, who called me and said, was very upset. He said, what am I going to do when these games are over? His whole life had been involved mm-hmm. with sport. And I've heard this, and I'm sure Joel has heard it time and again at his clinic, that athletes who start to anticipate, what's life going to be? Again, we talked about it earlier. Life becomes very defined as an elite athlete. You know, they talk about Phelps training 6-7 hours a day. You know, he eats, he sleeps, he works out, he competes. And athletes who get to that level kind of enjoy that lifestyle. I think what Carlos said is unfortunately a bit unique. I think one of the things we need to do within sport is to spend a bit more time on helping athletes transition from their competitive days to their non-competitive days, at least on the sports field. They're certainly competitive in the rest of life. I know I've heard Joel talk about this on other occasions, but that it's one of the areas we spend a lot of time and energy training and generating the next generation of Olympic or professional athletes, and I'm not sure there's been adequate time spent on helping them make that transition out of sport.
Joel, at one level, what David's talking about seems almost contradictory to what I'm hearing athletes need. What I'm getting from you guys is that athletes need to focus on the moment, what's happening now, what's happening right in front of you, and managing that, and that's part of how you get emotional toughness. And now you're talking about focusing on the big picture and what's going to happen way down the pike, and couldn't that interfere with the athletic training itself? What's your take on that, Joel?
Well, first of all, what Carlos was describing was a planned retirement, and I found there's a difference between transitioning when you're planning for it versus a guy I was working with last week, 20 years old, was dribbling a ball, and then his knee got ripped up, and that's a whole different, I think, transition. I think even when you're playing the sport, Dan, you can be building some life skills that are going to help you when you leave the sport. So you take a look at Michael Phelps, and he talks about eating all his meals with his teammates and going to other events and appreciating just the beauty of competition. Those are skills of curiosity, and those are skills of appreciation that are going to help him, I believe, whatever comes after swimming, which is an example of how sports can teach you life skills. With youth sport athletes, we're always trying to teach them multiple goals to define success. I know a lot of people just define success as winning, but can you assess if you're giving your best effort, and what did you learn today, and were you a good teammate, and did you enjoy yourself, did you smile once or twice? I think there's a lot of ways to define success that you can learn in sport and skills that can help you be good at the moment, but also equip you with the skills that are going to have to help you after your sport is over. And finally, when I'm working with athletes, no matter where I get them, it is really all about identity, and just keep answering that question, who are you? And are you John Smith, the basketball player, or are you John Smith who likes to play basketball? Help me understand that. What do you think? And so even when they're in the sport moment, Dan, I think there are some skills that they can learn that are going to better equip them for their post-sport days and also help them be better athletes at the same time.
You know, a lot of the questions you're raising, you know, who are you, and putting their sports performance in a larger context, I mean, makes sense for you to raise them. You're a psychologist, for God's sakes. That's what we do for a living. But not all athletes are working with a psychologist. David, you talked during the break about a coach, and I would think that the questions Joel raised are some of the questions a good coach would raise.
Well, I think it's a superb point that we need to maybe spend a few minutes on. It's the role of the coach. If you look at these Olympic athletes, many of them, in fact, most of them now at the elite level, will bring their own coach. I think the things that Joel's been talking about and Carlos mentioned, I think it's wonderful to have great parents, and parents can be an important factor. My experience has been that the role of the coach is really one that almost can't be overstated. I think a coach knows when to keep the athlete in the moment, keep them on winning this race. But I think when you have this lifelong coach like Phelps has, I mean, he's been with Bowman since he was a youngster, and you see that with many of the other Olympic athletes, that the role of the coach, I think it's unfair to ask an athlete when they're in the peak of competition to be thinking about what's it going to be like to be retired. I mean, these are oftentimes young kids or young adults, and that's just not right. I think that might potentially take away from their performance in the pool or on the court at that moment. But I think the coach, and this is where I feel a lot of our efforts in sports psychiatry, sports psychology, need to be dealing with the coaches. We wear the hat as a psychologist or a psychiatrist, and that comes along with certain expectations. But the coach, I think, really plays a critical role here.
I have a
Dan, if I could echo in here?
Pardon?
Dan, if I could echo in. Just
sure can, Carlos.
Speaking about the coaches, he couldn't be more right. I mean, I think part of society is that it's not – sports is made too big. It's actually too big. Yes, at the time you're in the sport – it is everything that you're about, everything you're about. But if you can't, at the end of the day, stop and then remove yourself and then spend time with your dog and your children and your family and adjust out of it, sports should only be a part of your entire life. And I think part of the problem, the big problem, is poor coaching throughout the country. You know, coaches like John Wooden and coaches that legendary coaches, they were the father figures in these players' lives a lot of times. And a player that comes from a one-parent family like myself or a number of these other kids from destitute situations, that one person that's showing them love and giving them direction is going to be their whole world.
Yes.
So if they just make just that sport their life and not tell them that that's part of it and develop out of it, then they're going to be stuck when they're done playing sports.
And we have somebody who's on hold who I think would love to join our conversation. Don? Don,
yes.
Do we have you? You there?
Yes, I'm here.
So I'm told by our producer that you're a speaker for the Positive Coaching Alliance?
That is correct. Yeah, I'm one of their champions here in the Delaware Valley.
So what is that?
Positive Coaching Alliance is a nonprofit organization that was started by Jim Thompson out of Stanford University, really to promote the a grassroots change from a outcome-based, a final score-based type of measurement or measurement of success for youth athletes to a more performance-based measurement system, getting the emphasis off the score and putting the emphasis back on the kid's personal improvement, the player's personal improvement from game to game.
So,
also,
go on.
The Positive Coaching Alliance has worked closely with Michigan State University's kinesiology department to come up with methodologies, coaching methodologies that focus on positive reinforcement. And the question I wanted to ask the experts here was, it's sort of a sanity check, and that is, Dan Gould's group up at Michigan State has come to the conclusion that a youth athlete requires 5 positive reinforcements for every constructive criticism you give them to keep them performing at the top emotional peak. And I'm just kind of wondering what your thoughts are on that. I mean, when I tell the average coach that, they roll their eyes at me and say they don't have time to give each kid 5 for 1.
Well,
but I do understand that when the ratio gets down below 3 to 1, kids are quoted as saying that they're in despair.
Okay. Well, I'll ask our experts to comment on that and ask you to take your answer off the air. For those who are listening, by the way, that's a pretty good ratio to keep a research shows that's a pretty good ratio to keep a marriage pretty happy, too. But David?
Well, I think the idea of positive reinforcement is very important. I think that really it's not a one-size-fits-all. I think what a good coach really knows is he knows his or her athlete and when they need that reinforcement, the encouragement, and when they need a kick in the can. And I think this is where the role of the coach becomes so critical. Unfortunately, how do you get up, you know, work up the ladders as you get winning teams? You know, you can have a great person. We mentioned John Wooden. Would we talk about John Wooden if they didn't win all those championships? So I think one of the things we have to keep in mind in sports is that all these things are very important and valuable, but sports is still about winning. We're talking about Michael Phelps because of what he did. You know, we talk about these great coaches because of what they accomplished. Unfortunately, I think what we need to do is make sure that the coaches understand that they are not only judged by the wins and losses. If you're a big winner, you're eccentric. If you do the same thing, you're a big loser, then, you know, then you're a bum. So I think it's a very important message that the caller brings up, but I think it varies with individuals. As we mentioned at the top of the show, some individuals are able to take criticism in a constructive way and turn it into a positive. It's how the athlete interprets it is probably at least as important as saying, well, you've done a really good job. I know athletes who've said, you know, the coach just said that, but I know I really did lousy. So it's not just saying it. It's how the coach knows that the athlete interprets that comment, whether it be meant to be positive or negative.
Carlos, we've only got another minute or so left, but you've been pretty successful since you've left sports, yes?
Yes.
And why is that? Why do you think that is? Is it some of that psychology you talked about earlier, your tenacity, your drive to accomplish?
It's drive to accomplish, but it's also wanting to just be successful, going back to what my mother said, be the best at whatever you can be in life. Once sports ended for me in that fashion, I found another way through International Student Athlete Academy to still help student athletes, to help others. And so then I was, with my degree in exercise physiology, I was then able to, I was just named top trainer in the city. So I was able to continue pushing forward and trying to be the best that I could be, but by applying those same things, tenacity, will, drive, just to end the conversation. I had mentioned John Wooden, but what John Wooden was really doing and is remembered, yes, we remember his wins, but we remember all the fine people that he developed. I think that's what coaches really need to start focusing on, developing the whole person of the athlete, and they'll find that they'll win more games also.
And, of course, like we learned, coaches need to be trained to do that. I'm sure a lot of coaches come into their career with certain attitudes about what needs to be done and how it needs to be done. And hopefully with people like all three of you and Don, who called us on the phone, that the education process will take place and these father figures will truly become the kind of mentors athletes need. I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us. I think it's been a great show.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
My guests have been Carlos Bradley, Joel Fish, and David Barron. Bradley is a former linebacker, played with the Chargers and the Eagles. He's executive vice president of the International Student Athlete Academy, where he trains athletes in academics and life skills. Joel Fish is director of the Center of Sports Psychology in Philadelphia. He's written 101 Ways to Be a Terrific Sports Parent. David Barron is chair of the Department of Psychiatry at Temple, and he's worked with Olympic athletes for over 25 years. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Elisa Walters and Gita Simons. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Have a great week, my friends.
Day to day.